Now, we live in an instant age, instant coffee, instant offices, instant messaging. We use credit cards to have stuff instantly rather than saving. Why wait for tomorrow when you can borrow for today? You can have it. Immediately, straight away, right now. We're less good at waiting, being patient, and holding on. My mum spent the last 2 weeks of her life in a hospice, and she asked that she wasn't left alone. And so each of the four siblings spent blocks of time with her through her last 2 weeks. And she spent those last days telling us of things that we'd never known as kids. Now, some were serious. She told us that our dad had cheated on her, been unfaithful to her a number of times. Some things she told us were just humorous, like Christmas time. Presents were placed under the Christmas tree. Children went off to school. My mother couldn't wait for Christmas Day, so she took her presents, unwrapped them, saw what had been given to her, rewrapped them, put them back under the Christmas tree, and then feigned surprise on Christmas Day. Waiting can be hard. And that appears to be the case in these last of our studies in the patriarch narrative of Genesis. Now, the chapter 16 is tightly written. You'll notice it opens and closes with biological information. So in verse 1, we're told that Sarai had borne Abraham no children. And then in verse 17, we're told that Abraham is 86 years old. Now, those two facts are the borders or the bookends of the narrative that comes in verse 1b through to 16. And therefore, we ought, by way of introduction, just ponder what we're being told by those bookend verses. First, verse 1, Sarai had borne Abraham no children. In the previous chapter, Abraham had been told that he would both have a son and that he would have as many descendants as stars in the sky. The second promise depends on the first promise. To have many descendants requires at least one son to be born. And yet that theme of descendants has run through the Abraham narrative like letters through a stick of rock. Does that phrase mean anything to you, like letters through a stick of rock? No. In England we have candy sticks that are named after the resort, and the letters of the resort are in a different colour to the candy all the way through the stick of the rock. So wherever you cut the rock, the name of the resort is there. Like letters through a stick of rock. Sorry. Language is different in New Zealand to England. I noticed that yesterday in McDonald's. I bought a regular flat white. It cost $3.90. I gave the lady a $5 bill and she said to me, "Epic." Epic. I said, really? Epic? She said, "Epic." I wanted to ask her what she would have said if something really amazing had happened. If you use epic for the giving of a $5 bill for a cup of coffee, I can't imagine what you... I just can't get my brain around what words you'd use. Epic! Letters through a stick of rock. You've learnt some new English today. You see, chapter 12 told us that there would be a great nation. Chapter 13 told of offspring like the dust of the ground. Chapter 15 had told us of stars in the sky. But chapter 16, verse 1, Sarai had borne no children. Now, if we, the reader, had been waiting for the son, you can only imagine the heartache for Sarai. You see, back in chapter 11, when we were introduced to this couple, that Sarai, we were told, was barren. Literally translated, her womb was dead. But she was 65. Do you think she might have come to terms by 65 that she wasn't going to have kids? But then imagine suddenly the bombshell. Abraham told in chapter 12, chapter 13, chapter 15, kids. When I married Jo, we were both in our 30s. And we decided that we wouldn't wait around to have children. We decided we'd be thrilled if they came straight away. And so we did nothing to prevent conception. But it actually took us 5 years to produce our first child. And we found that really hard. There was often tears. There was often sadness. And after a couple of years of trying, every month brought sadness, disappointment, and wondering whether we would ever have children. Sarai had borne no children. And then the second book ended in verse 17. Abraham is 86 years old. Back in chapter 12 and verse 4, when Abraham had first heard the promise, we were told he was 75 years old. Now he's 86. Take off a year or so for conceiving and pregnancy. And Abraham and Sarah, by the beginning of the chapter, have been waiting for 10 years. Indeed, in verse 3, the writer tells us that our maths is right. We are 10 years since Abraham has been living in Canaan. And nothing has happened. Can you imagine that? Nothing's happened for 10 years. Well, let's look at the meat in the middle of the chapter and the material inside the bookends, and three things for us to notice this morning. Well, this afternoon now. First, notice the small-mindedness. Now, I'm not sure that's the best heading, and so I'm announcing this morning a competition. Email me your better first headings by June, when I will preach this material again. And I will give the winning new heading a free registration at next year's Equip Conference. How about that? Pretty good, isn't it? So I want a better first heading than small-mindedness. Now, let's look at the text. The heading's not that important. Sarai has an Egyptian maidservant, verse 1. Perhaps she hired her a decade before when Sarai was in Pharaoh's palace, back in chapter 12. Now what's interesting is that in the first scene in this chapter, it is clearly Sarai leading Abraham. The link is made between the situation in verse 1 and what Sarai does in verse 2. So she said to Abraham. This is Sarai's plan. And the last line of verse 2, Abraham goes along with it. Here translated, Abraham agreed to what Sarai said. And again, the little link word at the beginning of verse 3. So, having waited 10 years for God to do something, Sarai has taken the bull by the horns and has concocted the plan. And notice that Sarai is the subject of the sentence that comes then in verse 3. She is the one in verse 3 who is taking centre stage. So after Sarai had been living in Canaan for 10 years, notice the object now of the sentence. Sarai, his wife, took the Egyptian maidservant Hagar and gave her to her husband to be his wife. It's she who gives Abraham Sarai. Gives Abraham Hagar, rather. Now, there's no direct rebuke for Sarai in the narrative. And it actually doesn't conflict with what we learned yesterday about Abraham not wavering in unbelief. You see, even in this episode, he still believes that he will have a son. But I think we are meant to see some small-mindedness, because as the story moves on, the Lord will insist in chapter 18 that the son of the promise will come from Abraham and Sarai. And small-mindedness here, because we're meant to spot the connections. Do you remember the tool we mentioned back on Monday, that whenever you read a Bible narrative, you need to read it having read the previous bit of that Bible narrative. So the writer here of Genesis in chapter 16 is expecting us to have read chapters 1 to 15. And therefore we ought to notice the strong connections with another woman who led her husband. Another husband who allowed himself to be led by his wife. And another situation where things end up badly. That little phrase, Abraham agreed, if you've got a more literal translation in front of you, like the ESV, and let me just say, in brackets, it's a good thing if you're preparing a Bible passage to read something like the NIV and read a more literal translation like the English Standard Version or the NASB. Read the more literal translation, and the more literal translation, I'm fairly sure the ESV will have translated it, Abraham listened to her. And that little phrase, listened to her, in the Hebrew, comes only one other time in the Old Testament. Can you guess where it comes? Genesis 3, Adam and Eve, in the garden. When God speaks in rebuke to Adam, he says, because you listened to her. And then comes the curse on the ground. But there's more. Did you spot it? As it was read to us there in verse 3, she took and gave to her husband. It's identical use of words to Genesis chapter 3. You remember, after Eve had eaten the fruit, she took and gave to her husband. Women to read Sarai's actions as a rerun of the sin of Genesis 3. Further, you can see in verses 3 and 4, there's no mention of Abraham by name. It's very striking. And all underlines that this act is Sarai leading her husband. Sarai's small-mindedness is that she concocts a scheme and leads her husband. Perhaps Aaron's small-mindedness is that he allows himself to be led by her. And trouble is only the result. Small-minded action that comes as a result of a long wait. Maybe that's the problem. Sarah's problem is that she thinks she needs to force the pace. She needs to fulfill God's promise for him. Is she like Eve, that she thinks she knows better than God? Certainly we see here another Bible illustration of the creation pattern of relationship being turned upside down. You see, the Bible's norm in both creation and in the church, through the gospel, is for wives to submit to their husbands and for husbands to love their wives. Eve led her husband. Sarai has led her husband. Adam fails to love his wife by stopping her. Abraham fails to love his wife by following her suggestion. Here is a small-mindedness that illustrates what happens when humans won't follow God's pattern for human relationships. And here is a small-mindedness that means Sarah doesn't think that God is big enough to deal with his own promise. That God isn't big enough to enable her to have children, even though her womb is dead and she's now old. It's a reminder to us. The pattern for relationships and the promises God makes are always worth following. Can I say it's always folly to think we know better than God when it comes to the ordering of relationships? And it's always folly if we think we need to force God's hand when it comes to the promises he has made. Know what's the New Testament? We should wait patiently. Yes, eagerly, but wait patiently. So let me ask you whether that's you. In terms of the pattern for relationships. If you're married, or you're planning to marry, will you accept that the Lord knows best when it comes to the pattern for marriage? Despite what our culture shouts at us, despite being labelled odd by non-Christians, because that's what they think, isn't it? When wives say they gladly and willingly want to submit to their husbands, and when husbands say they want to love their wives by laying down their lives for her, the world thinks we're nuts. Will you follow the pattern that God's given for married relationships? And then secondly, will you wait patiently for the Lord to fulfill his promises in his way and in his timing, not thinking that we have to bring what lies into the future and manufacture some way of delivering it in the present? That's exactly what the health, wealth and prosperity gospel's all about, isn't it? So what they've done is they've taken something that belongs to the future and brought it into the present, refusing to wait for God to fulfill his promises. There will be a time when you will be, if you're Christian, as healthy as you can ever be. You will be perfect. But that lies in the future. And what the health, wealth and prosperity monkeys do is they bring that future and say you can have it now. Whereas God hasn't promised it for now, he's promised it for the future. Will you wait? Small-mindedness. Secondly, troubled relationships. The parallels with Genesis 3 continue. Their troubled relationships followed the refusal to follow the creation pattern, and it's no different here. The consequences are immediate and they are bitter. The plan appears to have worked at the start of verse 4. But trouble begins. What Sarai must have thought was at the start of success turns into a tragedy as she began, at Hagar, to despise her mistress. And so we now see Hagar and Sarai in broken relationship. And that leads in verse 5 to Sarai and Abraham in broken relationship. Sarai's anger is aroused and again she takes the initiative. But notice the lack of personal responsibility. It's so often the case, isn't it? It was in the Garden of Eden. Is again here and is so often true of us, isn't it? Notice where she places the blame in verse 5. Can you see it? Then Sarai said to her husband, "You are responsible for the wrong that I am suffering. I put my servant in your arms, and now she knows she is pregnant. Well, she despises me. May the Lord judge between you and me." Remember in the Garden of Eden when God questions them about what they've done? Neither owned up, did they? Neither will take the responsibility. Both start pleading mitigating circumstances. Look what Sarai says. "You are responsible." I read recently in the paper of a case in the United States. A woman had been convicted and jailed for persistent shoplifting. And she, according to the newspaper, is now countersuing her own mother, blaming her, saying that her habit of shoplifting wasn't her fault, but was somehow the way she'd been mothered. It is read as a total refusal to accept blame, take personal responsibility, but that is humankind, isn't it? Have you noticed how politicians rarely accept they've ever made a mistake? And why is it? And why are we a bit like that too? Wasn't Jay's comments last night really helpful? Don't pretend sin isn't sin. It is. But we don't like to be humbled by accepting responsibility. And so because of our pride, we're so often like Sarai, so often like Adam and Eve. Well, I wonder what you'd have said in verse 6. I think I'd have been saying something like, Sarai, hang on a minute. Whose idea was this? Who took the initiative? What does he say? "Your servant's in your hands. Do with her whatever you think best." And Sarai ill-treated her. Now, we can't be exactly sure what Abraham is doing in saying verse 6. Many commentators think that he's saying, "You started it, you sort it out." Others think that Abraham is not treating Hagar as he should. Is she really just a servant now? Or is she in some way Abraham's wife? Now, whatever's right, the impact is the breakdown of relationships. Sarai and Hagar. Sarai and Abraham. And it leads to verse 6, Hagar fleeing. And that's the end of the first scene of the chapter. It's a total disaster, isn't it? Indeed, without the Lord's intervention that's going to come in a moment in verse 7, that's how it would have ended, a breakdown of relationship. But it's a great illustration of how the wisdom of man ends up in disaster. It's always that way. You see, we think we can see a better way than the purpose of God. We think we know better. We think our wisdom is better than his. We act on what we think is best, and it always leads to trouble. Read Romans 1. That is the sin of man. We think we know better than God, reject him and his ways and his wisdom. We think we're being jolly clever, claiming to be wise. We're actually being foolish, and it always ends up a mess. Well, in verse 7, the second section of the drama, and we see futures outlined. The scene takes place now in the desert, on one of the roads to Egypt. Hagar's going back home. And there the angel of the Lord speaks to her. And I think we're meant to see verse 7 to 14 as a distinct unit, because it opens with the mention of a spring in verse 7, and it concludes with the naming of that spring in verse 14. And encounters at wells are common in the Old Testament. The angel speaks in verse 8. For the first time, Hagar is called by her name. That must have surprised her. It doesn't surprise us, because we've been told that this is an angel of the Lord. And the angels of the Lord in the book of Genesis represent the Lord himself. This is a divine encounter. And given the angel knows Hagar's name, his question is perhaps a little bit surprising in verse 8. He said, "Hagar, servant of Sarai, where have you come from and where are you going?" Have you noticed that God does that in the Old Testament? He asks questions not because he doesn't know the answer. When God addressed Adam, "Where are you?" Or when the Lord asked Cain in Genesis 4, "Where is Abel?" It's not because God doesn't know the answer. No, rather it gives the questioned person an opportunity to respond. And notice, in contrast to others in the scriptures, that Hagar now answers honestly. "I'm running away from my mistress Sarai," she answered. The angel affirms that Hagar is still the servant of Sarai, and notice she is told to return to her. In verse 9, "Go back to your mistress and submit to her." Does that at first reading sound harsh and callous? Especially if you know that the word "submit" in the Hebrew is from the same root word as "ill-treated" back in verse 6. In other words, the angel is calling Hagar to continue as Sarai's servant with the hint that doing so will not be easy. But actually what's going on is gracious. Notice verse 10. The angel added, "I will so increase your descendants that they will be too numerous to count. I will greatly increase." And the angel then speaks again in verses 10 to 11, and we turn from prose to poetry, and the angel speaks prophecy. The future is now outlined. Cast your eye there at verse 11. First, the angel knows of her pregnancy. Secondly, he tells of the gender of the fetus, a son. Thirdly, she is told what to call him, Ishmael. Because in the Bible, names given by God often signify something about them. That used to be the case in England. Mr. Baker was called that because he baked bread, and Mr. Butcher was called that because he chopped meat, and so on. Mrs. Thatcher would be called that because she made roofs, I suppose. But the name Ishmael means "the Lord hears." And it's showing that God is being gracious here. He's heard of the misery that Hagar endured as a result of what Sarai had done. Here is the Lord being gracious and kind to Hagar. He hears the suffering of one outside Abraham's direct family. And Hagar is then told of the future of the baby. He will have a free-roaming Bedouin existence. The freedom that Hagar had sought for herself will be his. And being like a wild donkey, I heard you laughing, being like a wild donkey is actually not a negative expression, but is the connotation of a free spirit. But, verse 12, a freedom that will bring him into conflict, especially with his own brothers. And Hagar herself sees that what God has promised here in verses 11 and 12 is indeed a blessing from God. So she speaks in verse 13 of a God who has seen her. And in the scriptures, when God sees, it means he is careful towards. She understands that she has truly encountered a God who cares for her, who has heard her and who sees her. And so that's why the spring is named as it is. Well, the scene ends with the birth of Ishmael. Ishmael the son is born, which brings us to the end of the chapter. But we can't end there. We've got to see how this story unfolds and how the New Testament understands these characters, Hagar and Ishmael. Now, as the story moves on, Ishmael and Hagar stay within Abraham's family until the birth of Isaac, which happens in chapter 21. And in that chapter, Sarah wants Abraham to ditch Hagar. Abraham is then troubled by that. After all, Ishmael is his son. But the Lord speaks to Abraham and tells him that he should let Hagar and Ishmael go, but that the Lord will bless Ishmael, and that he will become the father of a great people. In other words, the promise to Hagar in chapter 16 will be fulfilled. And so the promise is again restated to her personally. And we wouldn't have to read much further on to see that the prophecy as well as the promise is fulfilled. If the promise is that there will be many descendants, then the prophecy is that he will be in enmity with his brothers. And by chapter 25, and what is it? Chapter 25, is it verse 19? Verse 18? As we read of Ishmael's sons, they lived in hostility towards all their brothers. And so by that point, the readers of Genesis are going to do what? The Lord has made a promise to Hagar and made a prophecy about Ishmael. A promise to Hagar, a prophecy about Ishmael, and both get fulfilled within 9 chapters of the book. Which is going to do what for the readers of Genesis? It's going to make you think God really does keep his promise and his prophecy. God does keep his word to Hagar. But did you spot the similarity between the promise to Hagar and the promise that had been made to Abraham earlier on? Countless descendants. Which means the readers of Genesis, when they don't see that promise to Abraham fulfilled, have utter confidence that God will fulfill it, because the similar promise he's made to Hagar is fulfilled. Do you get the point? The promise to Hagar of countless descendants, the promise to Hagar is fulfilled in Genesis, which means a similar promise to Abraham is believable, is even more believable for those who read the book. So you can now read the promise of Genesis 15 that we looked at yesterday and say, yes, 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 God really will keep his promises to me. He will. And if you believe God will keep his promise to you, what will you do? You'll keep going in faith. It's a marvellously faith-building episode. But again, we still can't end it there, because in the New Testament, Paul the Apostle teaches us about Hagar and Ishmael. In our last 3 minutes, we're going to flip to 2 New Testament passages. I wonder whether you'd go with me to them. The first is Galatians chapter 4. Galatians chapter 4. Would you turn to it? And in my NIV, large print, in my NIV, from verse 21, the NIV translators have put the header in Hagar and Sarah. Now, in Galatians chapter 4 and verse 22, notice, "For it is written that Abraham had 2 sons, one by the slave woman," that's Genesis 16, "and the other by the free woman," Genesis 21. "His son by the slave woman was born in the ordinary way, but the son of the free woman was born as the result of a promise." Now notice in verse 24, Paul says that these two women, Hagar and Sarah, represent 2 covenants. These things may be taken figuratively, for the women represent 2 covenants. One covenant is from Mount Sinai, and here's the utter bombshell. Can you see what Paul now says? One covenant is from Mount Sinai. One covenant represents the covenant made with Moses at Mount Sinai and bears children who are to be slaves. That is Hagar. The covenant with Moses, the children of that covenant are slaves, and they are the children of Hagar. Can I just try and spell out what Paul is saying? It is breathtaking. Paul is saying that unbelieving Jews in the first century unbelieving Jews in the first century in the city of Jerusalem are in fact children of Hagar. They are slaves. He is saying, unbelieving Jews, well, what did the descendants of Hagar, Ishmael become? Arabs. Paul is saying unbelieving Jews are Arabs. In contrast, Paul can say of Gentile Christians in Galatia that they are actually, verse 28, the children of the promise. We are not children of the slave woman. If we are Christians here today, whether we're Jewish by birth or not, and we discover that we're all not, then we are actually those drawn into the promises of Abraham. What Paul is saying is shocking. If a Jew is not a person of faith, they're still in slavery, they're still in Ishmael's family, they're under the covenant of Hagar. And it's worth checking at a conference like this. Whose family are you in? Are you in the family of Isaac and therefore a child of the promise? Or are you a child, well, as if you were an unbelieving Jew? In the family of Ishmael. Being in the family of Isaac means you're free. Not a slave anymore. Your freedom. You're free. So chapter 5 verse 1, it was for freedom that Christ has set you free. You're free. And the application in the book of Galatians, you're free. So don't go back to the law. As we were hearing from Jay, don't go back to the law. We're free. Do you believe that? We're free. And in the book of Galatians, you're free not just from Old Testament law, but you're free from man-made rules too. Don't make up man-made rules. You're free. But 1 minute left. Paul mentions Ishmael a second time. Flip back to Romans chapter 9. Romans chapter 9, it's a vital section in the book of Romans. Paul has ended Romans chapter 8 by telling us that we are absolutely sure of our future glory. We are heirs of glory and nothing can stop it coming about. But all of that rests on God keeping his promise. And so what if God has ratted on a promise in the past? If God has broken any promise in the past, how do you know he won't rat on his promises to you? The faithfulness of God and his word are of crucial importance. Has God broken promises to the Jews? That's what chapters 9 to 11 are really all about. And Paul's statement in chapter 9 verse 6 is absolutely clear, isn't it? It is not as though God's word has failed. God hasn't broken any promise. And the issue, therefore, is explained like this. Not every physical descendant of Abraham was actually a real Israelite. Just because you could trace your ancestry back to Abraham, just because you've been physically circumcised, does not mean you are actually in Abraham's family. It was always God's choice. So Paul can say here, not because they are his descendants are they all Abraham's children. On the contrary, it's through Isaac that your offspring will be reckoned. It's not the natural children, it's not that first child, Ishmael. It's Isaac. Paul goes on, and it was Jacob and not Esau. And the decision about that was made before either of those twins was born. And actually read the story, and Jacob's actually he's a tow rag. He's a scumbag. He's a conniving git. Is that a swear word here? We can say that in England. Jacob is awful. But God said it's going to be Jacob. And why is this? It is because, verse 12, so that God's election might stand, God's sovereign choice might stand. And that means if you're Christian here today, it is because God's chosen you. That's the way you got into the family. God chose you. And that is the most wonderfully assuring doctrine that there is. Because it's not about you and me. It's not about whether we're good or bad. It's God's sovereign plan. It's wonderfully assuring. Because you see, my identity doesn't rest in what I do. It all rests in God choosing me. Not to be part of the covenant with Hagar, but to be in the family of Isaac, of Abraham, the family that's chosen for glory. Does Genesis 16 really matter? It matters very much in the scriptures, because it's setting up two families, two lines, both with many descendants. If you will not believe and keep believing, you're in Ishmael's family and are enslaved. But if you believe, then you're part of the family of Isaac, the family of God's choice. And you can be absolutely sure that God will take you to future glory. Let's bow our heads and pray for a moment. Heavenly Father, we thank you that being in the family is all a matter of your choice, evidenced by our faith. It's all about your kindness and your grace. We thank you so much for it. And we pray that as we see the kind of God you are here in this chapter, you'd be kind enough to keep that faith in us until the day we die. Amen.